Chapter 23 Continued. Harry felt his heart lift. It was very good not to hear words of caution and protection for once. The headmasters and headmistresses around the walls seemed less impressed by Dumbledore's decision. Harry saw a few of them shaking their heads, and Phineas Nigellus actually snorted. "Does Voldemort know when a Horcrux is destroyed, sir? Can he feel it?" Harry asked, ignoring the portraits. "A very interesting question, Harry. I believe not. I believe that Voldemort is now so immersed in evil, and these crucial parts of himself have been detached for so long, he does not feel as we do. Perhaps at the point of death he might be aware of his loss, but he was not aware, for instance, that the diary had been destroyed until he forced the truth out of Lucius Malfoy. When Voldemort discovered that the diary had been mutilated and robbed of all its powers, I am told that his anger was terrible to behold." "But I thought he meant Lucius Malfoy to smuggle it into Hogwarts." "Yes, he did. Years ago, when he was sure he would be able to create more Horcruxes, but still Lucius was supposed to wait for Voldemort's say-so, and he never received it, for Voldemort vanished shortly after giving him the diary. No doubt he thought that Lucius would not dare do anything with the Horcrux other than guard it carefully, but he was counting too much upon Lucius's fear of a master who had been gone for years, and whom Lucius believed dead. Of course, Lucius did not know what the diary really was. I understand that Voldemort had told him the diary would cause the Chamber of Secrets to reopen, because it was cleverly enchanted. Had Lucius known he held a portion of his master's soul in his hands, he would undoubtedly have treated it with more reverence, but instead he went ahead and carried out the old plan for his own ends. By planting the diary upon Arthur Weasley's daughter, he hoped to discredit Arthur, have me thrown out of Hogwarts, and get rid of a highly incriminating object in one stroke. Ah, poor Lucius! What with Voldemort's fury about the fact that he threw away the Horcrux for his own gain, and the fiasco at the Ministry last year, I would not be surprised if he is secretly glad to be safe in Azkaban at the moment." Harry sat in thought for a moment, then asked, "So if all of his Horcruxes are destroyed, Voldemort could be killed?" "Yes, I think so," said Dumbledore. "Without his Horcruxes, Voldemort will be a mortal man with a maimed and diminished soul. Never forget, though, that while his soul may be damaged beyond repair, his brain and his magical power remain intact. It will take uncommon skill and power to kill a wizard like Voldemort, even without his Horcruxes." "But I haven't got uncommon skill and power," said Harry, before he could stop himself. "Yes, you have," said Dumbledore firmly. "You have a power that Voldemort has never had. You can—" "I know," said Harry impatiently. "I can love." It was only with difficulty that he stopped himself, adding, "big deal." "Yes, Harry, you can love," said Dumbledore, who looked as though he knew perfectly well what Harry had just refrained from saying, "which, given everything that has happened to you, is a great and remarkable thing. You are still too young to understand how unusual you are, Harry." "So, when the prophecy says that I'll have power the Dark Lord knows not, it just means love?" asked Harry, feeling a little let down. "Yes, just love," said Dumbledore. "But, Harry, never forget that what the prophecy says is only significant because Voldemort made it so. I told you this at the end of last year. Voldemort singled you out as the person who would be most dangerous to him, and in doing so, he made you the person who would be most dangerous to him." "But it comes to the same—" "No, it doesn't," said Dumbledore, sounding impatient now. Pointing at Harry with his black, withered hand, he said, you are setting too much store by the prophecy. But, spluttered Harry, but you said the prophecy means... If Voldemort had never heard of the prophecy, would it have been fulfilled? Would it have meant anything? Of course not. Do you think every prophecy in the Hall of Prophecy has been fulfilled? But, said Harry, bewildered, but last year you said one of us would have to kill the other. Harry, Harry, only because Voldemort made a grave error and acted on Professor Trelawney's words. If Voldemort had never murdered your father, would he have imparted in you a furious desire for revenge? Of course not. If he had not forced your mother to die for you, would he have given you a magical protection he could not penetrate? Of course not, Harry. Don't you see? Voldemort himself created his worst enemy, just as tyrants everywhere do. Have you any idea how much tyrants fear the people they oppress? All of them realize that one day, amongst their many victims, there is sure to be one who rises against them and strikes back. Voldemort is no different. Always he was on the lookout for the one who would challenge him. He heard the prophecy, and he leapt into action, with the result that he not only hand-picked the man most likely to finish him, he handed him uniquely deadly weapons. But it is essential that you understand this, said Dumbledore, standing up and striding about the room, his glittering robes swooshing in his wake. Harry had never seen him so agitated. By attempting to kill you, Voldemort himself singled out the remarkable person who sits here in front of me and gave him the tools for the job. It is Voldemort's fault that you were able to see into his thoughts, his ambitions, that you even understand the snake-like language in which he gives orders. And yet, Harry, despite your privileged insight into Voldemort's world, which, incidentally, is a gift any Death Eater would kill to have, you have never been seduced by the dark arts, never, even for a second, shown the slightest desire to become one of Voldemort's followers. Of course I haven't, said Harry indignantly. He killed my mum and dad. You are protected, in short, by your ability to love, said Dumbledore loudly. The only protection that can possibly work against the lure of power like Voldemort's. In spite of all the temptation you have endured, all the suffering, you remain pure of heart, just as pure as you were at the age of 11, when you stared into a mirror that reflected your heart's desire, and it showed you only the way to thwart Lord Voldemort, and not immortality or riches. Harry, have you any idea how few wizards could have seen what you saw in that mirror? Voldemort should have known then what he was dealing with, but he did not. But he knows it now. You have flitted into Lord Voldemort's mind without damage to yourself, but he cannot possess you without enduring mortal agony, as he discovered in the Ministry. I do not think he understands why, Harry, but he was in such a hurry to mutilate his own soul, he never paused to understand the incomparable power of a soul that is untarnished and whole. But, sir, said Harry, making valiant efforts not to sound argumentative, it all comes to the same thing, doesn't it? I've got to try and kill him, or... Got to? Said Dumbledore. Of course you've got to, but not because of the prophecy, because you yourself will never rest until you've tried. We both know it. Imagine, please, just for a moment, that you had never heard that prophecy. How would you feel about Voldemort now? Think. Harry watched Dumbledore striding up and down in front of him and thought. He thought of his mother, his father, and Sirius. He thought of Cedric Diggory. He thought of all the terrible deeds he knew Lord Voldemort had done. A flame seemed to leap inside his chest, searing his throat. "I'd want him finished," said Harry quietly. "And I'd want to do it."
"Of course you would," cried Dumbledore. "You see, the prophecy does not mean you have to do anything. But the prophecy caused Lord Voldemort to mark you as his equal. In other words, you are free to choose your way, quite free to turn your back on the prophecy. But Voldemort continues to set store by the prophecy. He will continue to hunt you. Which makes it certain, really, that
one of us is going to end up killing the other," said Harry. "Yes." But he understood at last what Dumbledore had been trying to tell him. It was, he thought, the difference between being dragged into the arena to face a battle to the death and walking into the arena with your head held high. Some people, perhaps, would say that there was little to choose between the two ways. But Dumbledore knew, and so do I, thought Harry with a rush of fierce pride, and so did my parents, that there was all the difference in the world. Chapter 24 Sectum Sempra. Exhausted but delighted with his night's work, Harry told Ron and Hermione everything that had happened during next morning's charms lesson, having first cast the Muffliato spell upon those nearest them. They were both satisfyingly impressed by the way he had wheedled the memory out of Slughorn, and positively awed when he told them about Voldemort's horcruxes and Dumbledore's promise to take Harry along should he find another one. "Wow," said Ron, when Harry had finally finished telling them everything. Ron was waving his wand very vaguely in the direction of the ceiling, without paying the slightest bit of attention to what he was doing. "Wow! You're actually going to go with Dumbledore and try and destroy... Wow!" "Ron, you're making it snow," said Hermione patiently, grabbing his wrist and redirecting his wand away from the ceiling, from which, sure enough, large white flakes had started to fall. Lavender Brown, Harry noticed, glared at Hermione from a neighbouring table through very red eyes, and Hermione immediately let go of Ron's arm. "Oh, yeah," said Ron, looking down at his shoulders in vague surprise. "Sorry, looks like we've all got horrible dandruff now." He brushed some of the fake snow off Hermione's shoulder. Lavender burst into tears. Ron looked immensely guilty and turned his back on her. "We split up," he told Harry out of the corner of his mouth. "Last night, when she saw me coming out of the dormitory with Hermione. Obviously she couldn't see you, so she thought it had just been the two of us." "Ah," said Harry. "Well, you don't mind it's over, do you?" "No," Ron admitted. "It was pretty bad while she was yelling, but at least I didn't have to finish it." "Coward," said Hermione, though she looked amused. "Well, it was a bad night for romance all round. Ginny and Dean split up too, Harry." Harry thought there was a rather knowing look in her eye as she told him that, but she could not possibly know that his insides were suddenly dancing the conga. Keeping his face as immobile and his voice as indifferent as he could, he asked, "How come?" "Oh, something really silly. She said he was always trying to help her through the portrait hole, like she couldn't climb in herself. But they've been a bit rocky for ages." Harry glanced over at Dean on the other side of the classroom. He certainly looked unhappy. "Of course, this puts you in a bit of a dilemma, doesn't it?" said Hermione.
"What do you mean?" said Harry quickly.
"The Quidditch team," said Hermione. "If Ginny and Dean aren't speaking..."
"Oh, yeah," said Harry. "Flitwick!" said Ron in a warning tone. The tiny little charms master was bobbing his way towards them, and Hermione was the only one who had managed to turn vinegar into wine. Her glass flask was full of deep crimson liquid, whereas the contents of Harry's and Ron's were still murky brown.
"Now, now, boys!" squeaked Professor Flitwick reproachfully. "A little less talk, a little more action. Let me see you try."
Together they raised their wands, concentrating with all their might, and pointed them at their flasks. Harry's vinegar turned to ice. Ron's flask exploded.
"Yes, for homework," said
Professor Flitwick, re-emerging from under the table and pulling shards of glass out of the top of his hat.
"Practice!"
They had one of their rare joint-free periods after charms and walked back to the common room together. Ron seemed to be positively light-hearted about the end of his relationship with Lavender, and Hermione seemed cheery too, though when asked what she was grinning about, she simply said, "It's a nice day." Neither of them seemed to have noticed that a fierce battle was raging inside Harry's brain. "She's Ron's sister."
"But she's ditched Dean."
"She's still Ron's sister."
"I'm his best mate."
"That'll make it worse."
"If I talk to him first..."
"He'd hit you."
"What if I don't care?"
"He's your best mate." Harry barely noticed that they were climbing through the portrait hole into the sunny common room, and only vaguely registered the small group of seventh years clustered together there, until Hermione cried,
"Katie, you're back! Are you okay?"
Harry stared. It was indeed Katie Bell, looking completely healthy and surrounded by her jubilant friends.
"I'm really well," she said happily. "They let me out of St. Mungo's on Monday. I had a couple of days at home with Mum and Dad, and then came back here this morning. Leanne was just telling me about McLagan and the last match, Harry."
"Yeah," said Harry. "Well, now you're back and Ron's fit, we'll have a decent chance of thrashing Ravenclaw, which means we could still be in the running for the cup. Listen, Katie." He had to put the question to her at once. His curiosity even drove Ginny temporarily from his brain. He dropped his voice as Katie's friends started gathering up their things. Apparently they were late for Transfiguration. "That necklace, can you remember who gave it to you now?"
"No,"
said Katie, shaking her head ruefully. "Everyone's been asking me, but I haven't got a clue. The last thing I remember was walking into the ladies in the Three Broomsticks."
"You definitely went into the bathroom then," said Hermione.
"Well, I know I pushed open the door," said Katie. "So I suppose whoever imperiously me was standing just behind it. After that, my memories are blank until about 2 weeks ago in St. Mungo's. Listen, I'd better go. I wouldn't put it past McGonagall to give me lines, even if it is my first day back."
She caught up her bag and books and hurried after her friends, leaving Harry, Ron and Hermione to sit down at a window table and ponder what she had told them.
"So, it must have been a girl or a woman who gave Katie the necklace," said Hermione, "to be in the ladies' bathroom."
"Or someone who looked like a girl or a woman," said Harry. "Don't forget there was a cauldron full of polyjuice potion at Hogwarts. We know some of it got stolen." In his mind's eye he watched a parade of crabs and goyles prance past, all transformed into girls. "I think I'm going to take another swig of Felix," said Harry, "and have a go at the Room of Requirement again."
"That would be a complete waste of potion," said Hermione flatly, putting down the copy of Spellman's Syllabary she had just taken out of her bag. "Luck can only get you so far, Harry. The situation with Slughorn was different. You always had the ability to persuade him, you just needed to tweak the circumstances a bit. Luck isn't enough to get you through a powerful enchantment, though. Don't go wasting the rest of that potion. You'll need all the luck you can get, if Dumbledore takes you along with him."
She dropped her voice to a whisper.
"Couldn't we make some more?" Ron asked Harry, ignoring Hermione. "It'd be great to have a stock of it. Have a look in the book."
Harry pulled his copy of Advanced Potion-Making out of his bag and looked up Felix Felicis. "Blimey, it's seriously complicated," he said, running an eye down the list of ingredients. "And it takes 6 months. You've got to let it stew." "Typical," said Ron. Harry was about to put his book away again when he noticed the corner of a page folded down. Turning to it, he saw the Sectum Semprar spell, captioned "For Enemies," that he had marked a few weeks previously. He had still not found out what it did, mainly because he did not want to test it around Hermione, but he was considering trying it out on McLagan next time he came up behind him unawares. The only person who was not particularly pleased to see Katie Bell back at school was Dean Thomas, because he would no longer be required to fill her place as chaser. He took the blow stoically enough when Harry told him, merely grunting and shrugging, but Harry had the distinct feeling as he walked away that Dean and Seamus were muttering mutinously behind his back. The following fortnight saw the best Quidditch practices Harry had known as captain. His team was so pleased to be rid of McLagan, so glad to have Katie back at last, that they were flying extremely well. Ginny did not seem at all upset about the break-up with Dean. On the contrary, she was the life and soul of the team. Her imitations of Ron anxiously bobbing up and down in front of the goalposts as the quaffle sped towards him, or of Harry bellowing orders at McLagan before being knocked out cold, kept them all highly amused. Harry, laughing with the others, was glad to have an innocent reason to look at Ginny. He had received several more bludger injuries during practice because he had not been keeping his eyes on the snitch. The battle still raged inside his head. Ginny or Ron? Sometimes he thought that the post-Lavender Ron might not mind too much if he asked Ginny out, but then he remembered Ron's expression when he had seen her kissing Dean, and was sure that Ron would consider it base treachery if Harry so much as held her hand. Yet Harry could not help himself talking to Ginny, laughing with her, walking back from practice with her. However much his conscience ached, he found himself wondering how best to get her on her own. It would have been ideal if Slughorn had given another of his little parties, for Ron would not be around. But unfortunately, Slughorn seemed to have given them up. Once or twice Harry considered asking for Hermione's help, but he did not think he could stand seeing the smug look on her face. He thought he caught it sometimes when Hermione spotted him staring at Ginny or laughing at her jokes. And to complicate matters, he had the nagging worry that if he didn't do it, somebody else was sure to ask Ginny out soon. He and Ron were at least agreed on the fact that she was too popular for her own good. All in all, the temptation to take another gulp of Felix Felicis was becoming stronger by the day, for surely this was a case for, as Hermione put it, tweaking the circumstances. The balmy days slid gently through May, and Ron seemed to be there at Harry's shoulder every time he saw Ginny. Harry found himself longing for a stroke of luck that would somehow cause Ron to realize that nothing would make him happier than his best friend and his sister falling for each other, and to leave them alone together for longer than a few seconds. There seemed no chance of either while the final Quidditch game of the season was looming. Ron wanted to talk tactics with Harry all the time and had little thought for anything else. Ron was not unique in this respect. Interest in the Gryffindor-Ravenclaw game was running extremely high throughout the school, for the match would decide the championship, which was still wide open. If Gryffindor beat Ravenclaw by a margin of 300 points, a tall order, and yet Harry had never known his team fly better, then they would win the championship. If they won by less than 300 points, they would come second to Ravenclaw. If they lost by 100 points, they would be third behind Hufflepuff, and if they lost by more than 100, they would be in fourth place. And nobody, Harry thought, would ever, ever let him forget that it had been he who had captained Gryffindor to their first bottom-of-the-table defeat in 2 centuries. The run-up to this crucial match had all the usual features. Members of rival houses attempting to intimidate opposing teams in the corridors, unpleasant chants about individual players being rehearsed loudly as they passed, the team members themselves either swaggering around enjoying all the attention or else dashing into bathrooms between classes to throw up. Somehow the game had become inextricably linked in Harry's mind with success or failure in his plans for Ginny. He could not help feeling that if they won by more than 300 points, the scenes of euphoria and a nice, loud, after-match party might be just as good as a hearty swig of Felix Felicis. In the midst of all his preoccupations, Harry had not forgotten his other ambition, finding out what Malfoy was up to in the Room of Requirement. He was still checking the Marauder's map and, as he was often unable to locate Malfoy on it, deduced that Malfoy was still spending plenty of time within the room. Although Harry was losing hope that he would ever succeed in getting inside the room, he attempted it whenever he was in the vicinity, but no matter how he reworded his request, the wall remained firmly doorless. A few days before the match against Ravenclaw, Harry found himself walking down to dinner alone from the common room, Ron having rushed off into a nearby bathroom to throw up yet again, and Hermione having dashed off to see Professor Vector about a mistake she thought she might have made in her last arithmancy essay. More out of habit than anything, Harry made his usual detour along the 7th-floor corridor, checking the Marauder's map as he went. For a moment he could not find Malfoy anywhere, and assumed he must indeed be inside the Room of Requirement again. But then he saw Malfoy's tiny labelled dot standing in a boy's bathroom on the floor below, accompanied not by Crabbe or Goyle, but by Moaning Myrtle. Harry only stopped staring at this unlikely coupling when he walked right into a suit of armour. The loud crash brought him out of his reverie. Hurrying from the scene lest Filch should turn up, he dashed down the marble staircase and along the passageway below. Outside the bathroom, he pressed his ear against the door. He couldn't hear anything. He very quietly pushed the door open. Draco Malfoy was standing with his back to the door, his hands clutching either side of the sink, his white blonde head bowed.
"Don't!" crooned Moaning Myrtle's voice from one of the cubicles. "Don't! Tell me what's wrong. I can help you." "No one can help me," said Malfoy. His whole body was shaking. "I can't do it. I can't. It won't work. And unless I do it soon, he says he'll kill me."
And Harry realized with a shock, so huge it seemed to root him to the spot, that Malfoy was crying. Actually crying. Tears streaming down his pale face into the grimy basin. Malfoy gasped and gulped, and then with a great shudder, looked up into the cracked mirror and saw Harry staring at him over his shoulder. Malfoy wheeled round, drawing his wand. Instinctively, Harry pulled out his own. Malfoy's hex missed Harry by inches, shattering the lamp on the wall beside him. Harry threw himself sideways, thought, "Levi Corpus!" and flicked his wand, but Malfoy blocked the jinx and raised his wand for another.
"No, no, stop it!"
squealed Moaning Myrtle, her voice echoing loudly around the tiled room.
"Stop! Stop!"
There was a loud bang, and the bin behind Harry exploded. Harry attempted a leg-locker curse that backfired off the wall behind Malfoy's ear and smashed the cistern beneath Moaning Myrtle, who screamed loudly. Water poured everywhere, and Harry slipped over as Malfoy, his face contorted, cried, "Crucifixum Sempra!" bellowed Harry from the floor, waving his wand wildly. Blood spurted from Malfoy's face and chest as though he had been slashed with an invisible sword. He staggered backwards and collapsed onto the waterlogged floor with a great splash, his wand falling from his limp right hand.
"No!"
gasped Harry. Slipping and staggering, Harry got to his feet and plunged towards Malfoy, whose face was now shining scarlet, his white hands scrabbling at his blood-soaked chest.
"No, I didn't..."
Harry did not know what he was saying. He fell to his knees beside Malfoy, who was shaking uncontrollably in a pool of his own blood. Moaning Myrtle let out a deafening scream.
"Murder! Murder in the bathroom! Murder!"
The door banged open behind Harry, and he looked up, terrified. Snape had burst into the room, his face livid. Pushing Harry roughly aside, he knelt over Malfoy, drew his wand, and traced it over the deep wounds Harry's curse had made, muttering an incantation that sounded almost like song. The flow of blood seemed to ease. Snape wiped the residue from Malfoy's face and repeated his spell. Now the wounds seemed to be knitting. Harry was still watching, horrified by what he had done, barely aware that he too was soaked in blood and water. Moaning Myrtle was still sobbing and wailing overhead. When Snape had performed his counter-curse for the third time, he half-lifted Malfoy into a standing position. "You need the hospital wing. There may be a certain amount of scarring, but if you take Dittany immediately, we might avoid even that. Come." He supported Malfoy across the bathroom, turning at the door to say in a voice of cold fury, "And you, Potter, you wait here for me." It did not occur to Harry for a second to disobey. He stood up slowly, shaking, and looked down at the wet floor. There were bloodstains floating like crimson flowers across its surface. He could not even find it in himself to tell Moaning Myrtle to be quiet, as she continued to wail and sob with increasingly evident enjoyment. Snape returned 10 minutes later. He stepped into the bathroom and closed the door behind him. "Go," he said to Myrtle, and she swooped back into her toilet at once, leaving a ringing silence behind her.
"I didn't mean it to happen,"
said Harry at once. His voice echoed in the cold, watery space.
"I didn't know what that spell did."
But Snape ignored this. "Apparently I underestimated you, Potter," he said quietly. "Who would have thought you knew such dark magic? Who taught you that spell?"
"I read about it somewhere."
"Where?"
"It was a library book," Harry invented wildly. "I can't remember what it was called."
"Liar," said Snape. Harry's throat went dry. He knew what Snape was going to do, and he had never been able to prevent it. The bathroom seemed to shimmer before his eyes. He struggled to block out all thought, but try as he might, the Half-Blood Prince's copy of Advanced Potion-Making swam hazily to the forefront of his mind. And then he was staring at Snape again, in the midst of this wrecked, soaked bathroom. He stared into Snape's black eyes, hoping against hope that Snape had not seen what he feared, but... "Bring me your school bag," said Snape softly, "and all of your school books. All of them. Bring them to me here. Now." There was no point arguing. Harry turned at once and splashed out of the bathroom. Once in the corridor, he broke into a run towards Gryffindor Tower. Most people were walking the other way. They gaped at him, drenched in water and blood, but he answered none of the questions fired at him as he ran past. He felt stunned. It was as though a beloved pet had turned suddenly savage. What had the prince been thinking to copy such a spell into his book? And what would happen when Snape saw it? Would he tell Slughorn, Harry's stomach churned, how Harry had been achieving such good results in potions all year? Would he confiscate or destroy the book that had taught Harry so much, the book that had become a kind of guide and friend? Harry could not let it happen. He could not. Why are you soaking? Is that blood? Ron was standing at the top of the stairs, looking bewildered at the sight of Harry. "I need your book," Harry panted. "Your potions book. Quick, give it to me!"
"But what about the half-blood? I'll explain later!"
Ron pulled his copy of Advanced Potion Making out of his bag and handed it over. Harry sprinted off past him and back to the common room. Here he seized his school bag, ignoring the amazed looks of several people who had already finished their dinner, threw himself back out of the portrait hole, and hurtled off along the seventh-floor corridor. He skidded to a halt beside the tapestry of dancing trolls, closed his eyes, and began to walk. "I need a place to hide my book. I need a place to hide my book. I need a place to hide my book." Three times he walked up and down in front of the stretch of blank wall. When he opened his eyes, there it was at last, the door to the room of requirement. Harry wrenched it open, flung himself inside, and slammed it shut. He gasped. Despite his haste, his panic, his fear of what awaited him back in the bathroom, he could not help but be overawed by what he was looking at. He was standing in a room the size of a large cathedral, whose high windows were sending shafts of light down upon what looked like a city with towering walls, built of what Harry knew must be objects hidden by generations of Hogwarts inhabitants. There were alleyways and roads bordered by teetering piles of broken and damaged furniture, stowed away perhaps to hide the evidence of mishandled magic, or else hidden by castle-proud house-elves. There were thousands and thousands of books, no doubt banned or graffitied or stolen. There were winged catapults and fanged frisbees, some still with enough life in them to hover half-heartedly over the mountains of other forbidden items. There were chipped bottles of congealed potions, hats, jewels, cloaks. There were what looked like dragon egg shells, corked bottles whose contents still shimmered evilly, several rusting swords, and a heavy, blood-stained axe. Harry hurried forwards into one of the many alleyways between all this hidden treasure. He turned right past an enormous stuffed troll, ran on a short way, took a left at the broken vanishing cabinet in which Montague had got lost the previous year, finally pausing beside a large cupboard which seemed to have had acid thrown at its blistered surface. He opened one of the cupboard's creaking doors. It had already been used as a hiding place for something in a cage that had long since died. Its skeleton had five legs. He stuffed the Half-Blood Prince's book behind the cage and slammed the door. He paused for a moment, his heart thumping horribly, gazing around at the clutter. Would he be able to find this spot again amidst all this junk? Seizing the chipped bust of an ugly old warlock from on top of a nearby crate, he stood it on the cupboard where the book was now hidden, perched a dusty old wig and a tarnished tiara on the statue's head to make it more distinctive, then sprinted back through the alleyways of hidden junk as fast as he could go, back to the door, back out onto the corridor, where he slammed the door behind him, and it turned at once back into stone. Harry ran flat out towards the bathroom on the floor below, cramming Ron's copy of Advanced Potion Making into his bag as he did so. A minute later, he was back in front of Snape, who held out his hand wordlessly for Harry's school bag. Harry handed it over, panting, a searing pain in his chest, and waited. One by one, Snape extracted Harry's books and examined them. Finally, the only book left was the potions book, which he looked at very carefully before speaking. "This is your copy of Advanced Potion Making, is it, Potter?" "Yes," said Harry, still breathing hard. "You're quite sure of that, are you, Potter?" "Yes," said Harry, with a touch more defiance. "This is the copy of Advanced Potion Making that you purchased from Flourish and Blotts?" "Yes," said Harry firmly. "Then why," asked Snape, "does it have the name Runil Waslib written inside the front cover?" Harry's heart missed a beat. "That's my nickname," he said. "Your nickname?" repeated Snape. "Yeah, that's what my friends call me," said Harry. "I understand what a nickname is," said Snape. The cold black eyes were boring once more into Harry's. He tried not to look into them. "Close your mind. Close your mind." But he had never learned how to do it properly. "Do you know what I think, Potter?" said Snape very quietly. "I think that you are a liar and a cheat, and that you deserve detention with me every Saturday until the end of term. What do you think, Potter?"
I don't agree, sir," said Harry, still refusing to look into Snape's eyes.
"Well, we shall see how you feel after your detentions," said Snape. 10 o'clock Saturday morning, Potter, my office."
"But, sir," said Harry, looking up desperately, "Quidditch, the last match of the—"
10 o'clock, whispered Snape, with a smile that showed his yellow teeth. "Poor Gryffindor. Fourth place this year, I fear." And he left the bathroom without another word, leaving Harry to stare into the cracked mirror, feeling sicker, he was sure, than Ron had ever felt in his life.
"I won't say I told you so," said Hermione, an hour later in the common room.
"Leave it, Hermione," said Ron angrily. Harry had never made it to dinner. He had no appetite at all. He had just finished telling Ron, Hermione, and Ginny what had happened. Not that there seemed to have been much need. The news had travelled very fast. Apparently Moaning Myrtle had taken it upon herself to pop up in every bathroom in the castle to tell the story. Malfoy had already been visited in the hospital wing by Pansy Parkinson, who had lost no time in vilifying Harry far and wide, and Snape had told the staff precisely what had happened. Harry had already been called out of the common room to endure 15 highly unpleasant minutes in the company of Professor McGonagall, who had told him he was lucky not to have been expelled, and that she supported wholeheartedly Snape's punishment of detention every Saturday until the end of term.
"I told you there was something wrong with that prince person," Hermione said, evidently unable to stop herself. "And I was right, wasn't I?"
"No, I don't think you were," said Harry stubbornly. He was having a bad enough time without Hermione lecturing him. The looks on the Gryffindor team's faces when he had told them he would not be able to play on Saturday had been the worst punishment of all. He could feel Ginny's eyes on him now, but did not want to meet them. He did not want to see disappointment or anger there. He had just told her that she would be playing Seeker on Saturday, and that Dean would be rejoining the team as Chaser in her place. Perhaps, if they won, Ginny and Dean would make up during the post-match euphoria.
The thought went through Harry like an icy knife.
"Harry," said Hermione, "how can you still stick up for that book when that spell—"
"Will you stop harping on about the book?" snapped Harry. "The prince only copied it out. It's not like he was advising anyone to use it. For all we know, he was making a note of something that had been used against him."
"I don't believe this," said Hermione. "You're actually defending—"
"I'm not defending what I did," said Harry quickly. "I wish I hadn't done it, and not just because I've got about a dozen detentions. You know I wouldn't have used a spell like that, not even on Malfoy. But you can't blame the prince. He hadn't written, 'Try this out, it's really good.' He was just making notes for himself, wasn't he? Not for anyone else."
"Are you telling me," said Hermione, "that you're going to go back and get the book?"
"Yeah, I am," said Harry forcefully.
"Listen, without the prince, I'd never have won the Felix Felicis. I'd never have known how to save Ron from poisoning. I'd never have got a reputation for potions brilliance you don't deserve," said Hermione nastily.
"Give it a rest, Hermione," said Ginny. And Harry was so amazed, so grateful, he looked up.
"By the sound of it, Malfoy was trying to use an unforgivable curse. You should be glad Harry had something good up his sleeve."
"Well, of course I'm glad Harry wasn't cursed," said Hermione, clearly stung. "But you can't call that Sectum Sempra spell good, Ginny. Look where it's landed him. And I'd have thought, seeing what this has done to your chances in the match—"
"Oh, don't start acting as though you understand Quidditch," snapped Ginny. "You'll only embarrass yourself."
Harry and Ron stared. Hermione and Ginny, who had always got on together very well, were now sitting with their arms folded, glaring in opposite directions. Ron looked nervously at Harry, then snatched up a book at random and hid behind it. Harry, however, though he knew he little deserved it, felt unbelievably cheerful all of a sudden, even though none of them spoke again for the rest of the evening. His light-heartedness was short-lived. There were Slytherin taunts to be endured next day, not to mention much anger from fellow Gryffindors, who were most unhappy that their captain had got himself banned from the final match of the season. By Saturday morning, whatever he might have told Hermione, Harry would have gladly exchanged all the Felix Felicis in the world to be walking down to the Quidditch pitch with Ron, Ginny, and the others. It was almost unbearable to turn away from the mass of students streaming out into the sunshine, all of them wearing rosettes and hats and brandishing banners and scarves, to descend the stone steps into the dungeons and walk until the distant sounds of the crowd were quite obliterated, knowing that he would not be able to hear a word of commentary or a cheer or groan.
"Ah, Potter," said Snape, when Harry had knocked on his door and entered the unpleasantly familiar office that Snape, despite teaching floors above now, had not vacated. It was as dimly lit as ever, and the same slimy, dead objects were suspended in coloured potions all around the walls. Ominously, there were many cobwebbed boxes piled on a table where Harry was clearly supposed to sit. They had an aura of tedious, hard, and pointless work about them. "Mr. Filch has been looking for someone to clear out these old files," said Snape softly. "They are the records of other Hogwarts wrongdoers and their punishments. Where the ink has grown faint, or the cards have suffered damage from mice, we would like you to copy out the crimes and punishments afresh, and, making sure that they are in alphabetical order, replace them in the boxes. You will not use magic."
"Right, Professor," said Harry, with as much contempt as he could put into the last three syllables.
"I thought you could start," said Snape, a malicious smile on his lips, "with boxes 1012 to 1056. You will find some familiar names in there, which should add interest to the task. Here, you see? He pulled out a card from one of the topmost boxes with a flourish, and read, James Potter and Sirius Black, apprehended using an illegal hex upon Bertram Aubrey. Aubrey's head twice normal size, double detention. Snape sneered. It must be such a comfort to think that, though they are gone, a record of their great achievements remains. Harry felt the familiar boiling sensation in the pit of his stomach. Biting his tongue to prevent himself retaliating, he sat down in front of the boxes and pulled one towards him. It was, as Harry had anticipated, useless, boring work, punctuated, as Snape had clearly planned, with the regular jolt in the stomach that meant he had just read his father or Sirius's names, usually coupled together in various petty misdeeds, occasionally accompanied by those of Remus Lupin and Peter Pettigrew. And while he copied out all their various offences and punishments, he wondered what was going on outside, where the match would have just started, Ginny playing Seeker against Cho. Harry glanced again and again at the large clock ticking on the wall. It seemed to be moving half as fast as a regular clock. Perhaps Snape had bewitched it to go extra slowly. He could not have been here for only half an hour. An hour? An hour and a half? Harry's stomach started rumbling when the clock showed 12:30. Snape, who had not spoken at all since setting Harry his task, finally looked up at 1:10. "I think that will do," he said coldly. "Mark the place you have reached. You will continue at 10 o'clock next Saturday." "Yes, sir." Harry stuffed a bent card into the box at random and hurried out of the door before Snape could change his mind, racing back up the stone steps, straining his ears to hear a sound from the pitch. But all was quiet. It was over, then. He hesitated outside the crowded great hall, then ran up the marble staircase. Whether Gryffindor had won or lost, the team usually celebrated or commiserated in their own common room. "Quid agis?" he said tentatively to the fat lady, wondering what he would find inside. Her expression was unreadable as she replied, "You'll see," and she swung forwards. A roar of celebration erupted from the hole behind her. Harry gaped as people began to scream at the sight of him. Several hands pulled him into the room. "We won!" yelled Ron, bounding into sight and brandishing the silver cup at Harry. "We won! 450 to 140! We won!" Harry looked around. There was Ginny running towards him. She had a hard, blazing look in her face as she threw her arms around him. And without thinking, without planning it, without worrying about the fact that 50 people were watching, Harry kissed her. After several long moments, or it might have been 30 minutes, or possibly several sunlit days, they broke apart. The room had gone very quiet. Then several people wolf-whistled, and there was an outbreak of nervous giggling. Harry looked over the top of Ginny's head to see Dean Thomas holding a shattered glass in his hand and Romilda Vane looking as though she might throw something. Hermione was beaming, but Harry's eyes sought Ron. At last he found him, still clutching the cup and wearing an expression appropriate to having been clubbed over the head. For a fraction of a second they looked at each other. Then Ron gave a tiny jerk of the head that Harry understood to mean, "Well, if you must." The creature in his chest roaring in triumph, Harry grinned down at Ginny, and gestured wordlessly out of the portrait hole. A long walk in the grounds seemed indicated, during which, if they had time, they might discuss the match. Chapter 25. The Seer Overheard. The fact that Harry Potter was going out with Ginny Weasley seemed to interest a great number of people, most of them girls, yet Harry found himself newly and happily impervious to gossip over the next few weeks. After all, it made a very nice change to be talked about because of something that was making him happier than he could remember being for a very long time, rather than because he had been involved in horrific scenes of dark magic.
"You'd think people had better things to gossip about," said Ginny, as she sat on the common room floor, leaning against Harry's legs and reading the Daily Prophet. "Three dementor attacks in a week, and all Romilda Vane does is ask me if it's true you've got a hippogriff tattooed across your chest."
Ron and Hermione both roared with laughter. Harry ignored them. "What did you tell her?"
"I told her it's a Hungarian horntail," said Ginny, turning a page of the newspaper idly. "Much more macho."
"Thanks," said Harry, grinning. "And what did you tell her Ron's got?"
"A pygmy puff, but I didn't say where."
Ron scowled as Hermione rolled around laughing. "Watch it," he said, pointing warningly at Harry and Ginny. "Just because I've given my permission doesn't mean I can't withdraw it."
"Your permission?" scoffed Ginny. "Since when did you give me permission to do anything? Anyway, you said yourself you'd rather it was Harry than Michael or Dean."
"Yeah, I would," said Ron grudgingly. "And just as long as you don't start snogging each other in public."
"You filthy hypocrite! What about you and Lavender, thrashing around like a pair of eels all over the place?"
demanded Ginny. But Ron's tolerance was not to be tested much as they moved into June, for Harry and Ginny's time together was becoming increasingly restricted. Ginny's OWLs were approaching, and she was therefore forced to revise for hours into the night. On one such evening, when Ginny had retired to the library, and Harry was sitting beside the window in the common room, supposedly finishing his herbology homework, but in reality reliving a particularly happy hour he had spent down by the lake with Ginny at lunchtime, Hermione dropped into the seat between him and Ron with an unpleasantly purposeful look on her face.
"I want to talk to you, Harry."
"What about?" said Harry suspiciously. Only the previous day Hermione had told him off for distracting Ginny when she ought to be working hard for her examinations.
"The so-called half-blood prince."
"Oh, not again," he groaned. "Will you please drop it?" He had not dared to return to the room of requirement to retrieve his book, and his performance in potions was suffering accordingly, though Slughorn, who approved of Ginny, had jocularly attributed this to Harry being lovesick. But Harry was sure that Snape had not yet given up hope of laying hands on the prince's book, and was determined to leave it where it was while Snape remained on the lookout.
"I'm not dropping it," said Hermione firmly, "until you've heard me out. Now, I've been trying to find out a bit about who might make a hobby of inventing dark spells."
"He didn't make a hobby of it."
"He? He? Who says it's a he?" "We've been through this," said Harry crossly. "Prince, Hermione, prince!" "Right," said Hermione, red patches blazing in her cheeks as she pulled a very old piece of newsprint out of her pocket and slammed it down on the table in front of Harry. "Look at that. Look at the picture." Harry picked up the crumbling piece of paper and stared at the moving photograph, yellowed with age. Ron leaned over for a look too. The picture showed a skinny girl of around 15. She was not pretty. She looked simultaneously cross and sullen, with heavy brows and a long, pallid face. Underneath the photograph was the caption, "Eileen Prince, Captain of the Hogwarts Gobstones Team."
"So?" said Harry, scanning the short news item to which the picture belonged. It was a rather dull story about inter-school competitions.
Her name was Eileen Prince. Prince, Harry!
They looked at each other, and Harry realized what Hermione was trying to say. He burst out laughing.
No way!
What?
You think she was the half-blood...
Oh, come on!
Well, why not? Harry, there aren't any real princes in the wizarding world. It's either a nickname, a made-up title somebody's given themselves, or it could be their actual name, couldn't it? Now, listen, if, say, her father was a wizard whose surname was Prince, and her mother was a muggle, then that would make her a half-blood prince.
Yeah, very ingenious, Hermione.
But it would. Maybe she was proud of being half a prince.
Listen, Hermione, I can tell it's not a girl. I can just tell.
The truth is, you don't think a girl would have been clever enough,
said Hermione angrily.
How can I have hung round with you for 5 years and not think girls are clever?
Said Harry, stung by this.
It's the way he writes. I just know the prince was a bloke, I can tell. This girl hasn't got anything to do with it.
Where did you get this, anyway?
The library, said Hermione predictably. There's a whole collection of old prophets up there. Well, I'm going to find out more about Eileen Prince, if I can.
Enjoy yourself, said Harry irritably.
I will, said Hermione. And the first place I'll look, she shot at him as she reached the portrait hole, is records of old potions awards.
Harry scowled after her for a moment, then continued his contemplation of the darkening sky. She's just never got over you outperforming her in potions, said Ron, returning to his copy of 1,000 Magical Herbs and Fungi.
You don't think I'm mad, wanting that book back, do you?
Course not, said Ron robustly. He was a genius, the prince. Anyway, without his bezoar tip...
He drew his finger significantly across his own throat.
I wouldn't be here to discuss it, would I? I mean, I'm not saying that spell you used on Malfoy was great.
Nor am I, said Harry quickly.
But he healed all right, didn't he? Back on his feet in no time.
Yeah, said Harry. This was perfectly true, although his conscience squirmed slightly all the same, thanks to Snape.
You still got detention with Snape this Saturday, Ron continued.
Yeah, and the Saturday after that, and the Saturday after that, sighed Harry.
And he's hinting now that if I don't get all the boxes done by the end of term, we'll carry on next year.
He was finding these detentions particularly irksome because they cut into the already limited time he could have been spending with Ginny. Indeed, he had frequently wondered lately whether Snape did not know this, for he was keeping Harry later and later every time while making pointed asides about Harry having to miss the good weather and the varied opportunities it offered. Harry was shaken from these bitter reflections by the appearance at his side of Jimmy Peaks, who was holding out a scroll of parchment.
"Thanks, Jimmy. Hey, it's from Dumbledore," said Harry excitedly, unrolling the parchment and scanning it. "He wants me to go to his office as quick as I can."
They stared at each other.
"Blimey," whispered Ron. "You don't reckon he hasn't found..."
"Better go and see, hadn't I?" said Harry, jumping to his feet. He hurried out of the common room and along the seventh floor as fast as he could, passing nobody but Peeves, who swooped past in the opposite direction, throwing bits of chalk at Harry in a routine sort of way, and cackling loudly as he dodged Harry's defensive jinx. Once Peeves had vanished, there was silence in the corridors. With only 15 minutes left until curfew, most people had already returned to their common rooms. And then Harry heard a scream and a crash. He stopped in his tracks, listening.
"How dare you!"
The noise was coming from a corridor nearby.
Harry sprinted towards it, his wand at the ready, hurtled around another corner, and saw Professor Trelawney sprawled upon the floor, her head covered in one of her many shawls, several sherry bottles lying beside her, one broken.
"Professor!"
Harry hurried forwards and helped Professor Trelawney to her feet. Some of her glittering beads had become entangled with her glasses. She hiccuped loudly, patted her hair, and pulled herself up on Harry's helping arm.
"What happened, Professor?"
"You may well ask," she said shrilly. "I was strolling along, brooding upon certain dark portents I happened to have glimpsed."
But Harry was not paying much attention. He had just noticed where they were standing. There on the right was the tapestry of dancing trolls, and on the left that smoothly impenetrable stretch of stone wall that concealed...
"Professor, were you trying to get into the Room of Requirement?"
"Omens I have been vouchsafed. What?"
She looked suddenly shifty.
"The Room of Requirement," repeated Harry. "Were you trying to get in there?"
I didn't know students knew about..."
"Not all of them do," said Harry. "But what happened? You screamed. It sounded as though you were hurt."
Said
Professor Trelawney, drawing her shawls around her defensively and staring down at him with her vastly magnified eyes.
"I wished to deposit certain personal items in the room,"
and she muttered something about
"nasty accusations."
"Right," said Harry, glancing down at the sherry bottles.
"But you couldn't get in and hide them?"
He found this very odd. The room had opened for him, after all, when he had wanted to hide the Half-Blood Prince's book.
"Oh, I got in all right," said Professor Trelawney, glaring at the wall. "But there was somebody already in there."
"Somebody in? Who?" demanded Harry. "Who was in there?"
"I have no idea," said Professor Trelawney, looking slightly taken aback at the urgency in Harry's voice. "I walked into the room, and I heard a voice, which has never happened before in all my years of hiding... of using the room, I mean."
"A voice saying what?"
"I don't know that it was saying anything," said Professor Trelawney. "It was whooping."
"Whooping?"
"Gleefully," she said, nodding.
Harry stared at her.
"Was it male or female?"
"I would hazard a guess at male," said Professor Trelawney.
"And it sounded happy?"
"Very happy," said Professor Trelawney sniffily.
"As though it was celebrating?"
"Most definitely."
"And then?"
"And then I called out, 'Who's there?'"
"You couldn't have found out who it was without asking?" Harry asked her, slightly frustrated.
"The inner eye," said Professor Trelawney with dignity, straightening her shawls and many strands of glittering beads, "was fixed upon matters well outside the mundane realms of whooping voices."
"Right," said Harry hastily.
He had heard about Professor Trelawney's inner eye all too often before.
"And did the voice say who was there?"
"No, it did not," she said. "Everything went pitch black, and the next thing I knew, I was being hurled headfirst out of the room."
"And you didn't see that coming?" said Harry, unable to help himself.
"No, I did not. As I say, it was pitch..."
She stopped and glared at him suspiciously.
"I think you'd better tell Professor Dumbledore," said Harry. "He ought to know that Malfoy's celebrating... I mean that someone threw you out of the room."
To his surprise, Professor Trelawney drew herself up at this suggestion, looking haughty.
"The headmaster has intimated that he would prefer fewer visits from me," she said coldly. "I am not one to press my company upon those who do not value it. If Dumbledore chooses to ignore the warnings the cards show..."
Her bony hand closed suddenly around Harry's wrist.
"Again and again, no matter how I lay them out."
And she pulled a card dramatically from underneath her shawls.
"The lightning-struck tower," she whispered. "Calamity, disaster, coming nearer all the time."
"Right," said Harry again. "Well, I still think you should tell Dumbledore about this voice and everything going dark and being thrown out of the room."
"You think so?"
Professor Trelawney seemed to consider the matter for a moment, but Harry could tell that she liked the idea of retelling her little adventure.
"I'm going to see him right now," said Harry. "I've got a meeting with him. We could go together."
"Oh, well, in that case," said Professor Trelawney with a smile. She bent down, scooped up her sherry bottles, and dumped them unceremoniously in a large blue-and-white vase standing in the nearby niche.
"I miss having you in my classes, Harry," she said soulfully as they set off together. "You were never much of a seer, but you were a wonderful object."
Harry did not reply. He had loathed being the object of Professor Trelawney's continual predictions of doom.
"I am afraid," she went on, "that the nag, I'm sorry, the centaur, knows nothing of cartomancy. I asked him, one seer to another, had he not, too, sensed the distant vibrations of coming catastrophe? But he seemed to find me almost comical. Yes, comical!"
Her voice rose rather hysterically, and Harry caught a powerful whiff of sherry, even though the bottles had been left behind.
"Perhaps the horse has heard people say that I have not inherited my great-great-grandmother's gift. Those rumours have been bandied about by the jealous for years. You know what I say to such people, Harry? Would Dumbledore have let me teach at this great school, put so much trust in me all these years, had I not proved myself to him?"
Harry mumbled something indistinct.
"I well remember my first interview with Dumbledore," went on Professor Trelawney in throaty tones. "He was deeply impressed, of course, deeply impressed. I was staying at the Hog's Head, which I do not advise, incidentally. Bedbugs, dear boy. But funds were low. Dumbledore did me the courtesy of calling upon me in my room at the inn. He questioned me. I must confess that at first I thought he seemed ill-disposed towards divination, and I remember I was starting to feel a little odd. I had not eaten much that day, but then—"
And now Harry was paying attention properly for the first time, for he knew what had happened then. Professor Trelawney had made the prophecy that had altered the course of his whole life, the prophecy about him and Voldemort.
"But then we were rudely interrupted by Severus Snape."
"What?"
"Yes, there was a commotion outside the door, and it flew open, and there was that rather uncouth barman standing with Snape, who was waffling about having come the wrong way up the stairs, although I'm afraid that I myself rather thought he had been apprehended eavesdropping on my interview with Dumbledore. You see, he himself was seeking a job at the time, and no doubt hoped to pick up tips. Well, after that, you know, Dumbledore seemed much more disposed to give me a job. And I could not help thinking, Harry, that it was because he appreciated the stark contrast between my own unassuming manners and quiet talent compared to the pushing, thrusting young man who was prepared to listen at keyholes. Harry, dear?"
She looked back over her shoulder, having only just realized that Harry was no longer with her. He had stopped walking, and they were now 10 feet from each other.
"Harry?"
she repeated uncertainly. Perhaps his face was white to make her look so concerned and frightened. Harry was standing stock still as waves of shock crashed over him, wave after wave, obliterating everything except the information that had been kept from him for so long. It was Snape who had overheard the prophecy. It was Snape who had carried the news of the prophecy to Voldemort. Snape and Peter Pettigrew together had sent Voldemort hunting after Lily and James and their son. Nothing else mattered to Harry just now.
"Harry," said Professor Trelawney again, "Harry, I thought we were going to see the headmaster together."
"You stay here," said Harry through numb lips.
"But, dear, I was going to tell him how I was assaulted in the room of—"
"You stay here," Harry repeated angrily. She looked alarmed as he ran past her, round the corner, into Dumbledore's corridor, where the lone gargoyle stood sentry. Harry shouted the password at the gargoyle and ran up the moving spiral staircase 3 steps at a time. He did not knock upon Dumbledore's door, he hammered, and the calm voice answered, "Enter," after Harry had already flung himself into the room. Fawkes the Phoenix looked round, his bright black eyes gleaming with reflected gold from the sunset beyond the window. Dumbledore was standing at the window, looking out at the grounds, a long black travelling cloak in his arms. "Well, Harry, I promised that you could come with me." For a moment or two, Harry did not understand. The conversation with Trelawney had driven everything else out of his head, and his brain seemed to be moving very slowly. "Come with you?" "Only if you wish it, of course." "If I..." And then Harry remembered why he had been eager to come to Dumbledore's office in the first place. "You found one? You found a Horcrux?" "I believe so."